Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, Holiday Extravaganza. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. All month long, I'll bring you interviews with authors chatting about their holiday-themed cozies. You'll also hear authors sharing their special holiday memories. And you'll find holiday photos and recipes on the podcast Instagram. Happy listening. Welcome, listeners, to another bonus episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. Author Lisa Manuel, writing as Alyssa Maxwell, joins me in the corner to chat about A Deadly Endowment, her newest A Lady and Lady's Maid mystery. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Alexia. I really appreciate you having me tonight.
Now, you're quite well known for your Gilded Newport mysteries, which are set in Gilded Age, Rhode Island. Your Lady and Lady's Maid mysteries, of which A Deadly Endowment's the seventh, take us across an ocean to post-World War I England. Would you please tell us what's happening in A Deadly Endowment?
Sure. It's been a couple of years now since World War I ended, and a lot of people are short of money, and that includes the aristocratic families. So Phoebe Renshaw, who is the granddaughter of an earl, decides that one way to help the tenant farmers and the villagers with things like repairs and you know, whatever is needed to be done would be to open the family estate to tours. So she and her lady's maid, Eva Huntford, get it organized, and they invite members of a local historical society and some school children from the village to be their first guests for their first tour. Now, Phoebe's grandparents really weren't into this idea, and her siblings were divided on it. They, you know, some of them thought it was a good idea, some thought, oh, this is kind of crass, but Phoebe convinced them and that this would be a good idea. Well, once everybody arrives, she and Eva pretty soon decide this was not such a great idea because it's really more than they can handle. The kids are running around, and every time they turn around, somebody's missing. Maybe a member of the historical society has wandered off into another room by themselves. They really have a hard time keeping everybody together. And halfway through, the two of them just can't wait till it's over. Well, they finally have somebody outside. They finally have everyone outside, but somebody is missing. One of the Historical Society members who is writing a book about the great country houses of the Cotswolds hasn't come out, and they figure, all right, she must have found something to tweak her interest and she's still in the house. Well, Eva goes back in to find her, discovers her in the library on the floor, strangled with a drapery cord. And immediately, the other six members of the Historical Society become suspects. The woman's son, most of all, but once Eva and Phoebe start investigating, they find out that every member of the society has something to hide, some secret they're desperate to keep hidden, and they start having lots of fun connecting all the dots and figuring out, you know, this tangled web of relationships between these people.
Now, a group of people at an English country house, one of whom's a murderer, is a classic, golden age classic theme in mystery fiction.
Yes.
Did you kind of play on that classic theme, and how did you sort of twist it to make it your own?
Well, really, this series is based on that. You know, the old country house kind of mystery, as well as a play on Downton Abbey. For this particular book, though, I'm going to go back real quick and just say that anybody born after about 1975 probably doesn't realize how important board games were to us growing up. We didn't have video games. We barely had TV. We had three channels in those days. So board games really, you know, was a favorite hobby. Kids couldn't play outside. They were stuck in the house. You brought out the board games. And one of my favorite, of course, was Clue. So, you know, when I started, you know, bringing these people around the house, I realized, you know, we kind of have a Colonel Mustard type and a Professor Plum type and a Miss Scarlet, you know, and yeah, so it kind of was a takeoff on the game of Clue, and which was just a lot of fun for me.
So another thing that people may not realize is that in real life, a lot of these fabulous estates do actually end up opening their doors to tourists and locals to sort of wander around in. No, especially this time of year. This is a time when you get a lot of real life estates dressed up in their holiday day finery. And we're so kind of awed by the spectacle. We don't think that, you know, somebody actually lives here. So, you know, what's, you know, as you mentioned, you know, your protagonists are kind of, you have second thoughts about doing this, but they didn't just do it on a lark. So, you know, what kind of goes into the decision to open your house to a bunch of strangers who can afford the entrance fee?
I think desperate times. Before the war, fortunes had already taken a downturn in England, which is why they were so keen on marrying American heiresses and getting that industrialist money, you know, to feed their coffers. But after the war, things got even worse because, you know, the war ate away at the economy. There were the terrible taxes. If somebody died, the inheritance taxes were huge. And a lot of these estates were already becoming white elephants. And yet in England, that sense of being part of the land and being part of an estate for generations and generations was so strong that I think even more here than, more there than here in America, they were just willing to do as much as they possibly could to hang on to that legacy, not only for themselves, but for the generations to come. Now, you know, I said Phoebe's grandparents were not too keen on the idea. Her grandmother is absolutely aghast at the idea of people traipsing through her house, strangers. But Phoebe reminds her grandfather that they don't really own Foxwood Hall. They are the current custodians of the property. They're there to take care of it, to take care of the village around it and the tenant farm so that it does last for, you know, a future generations. So it's just one of those things, you know, stiff upper lip, you kind of suck it up and you do it for the good of all.
That's at least my next question. There's a popular Christmas movie out now called A Castle for Christmas. Where we learned that, have you seen it?
I did. I have.
I'm actually not going to make fun of it because I actually liked it because it was Brooke Shields and Carrie Elwes, and it was so nice to see some over 40 people in a romance.
Absolutely agree with you there. Yes.
Even if I had to put up with Elwes's Scottish accent, but that's another story.
It's okay. We forgive him.
But in that movie, you know, there's the scene where we find out how many responsibilities, both financial and moral, really, to the villages and farms that the Duke has. And you mentioned that, you know, same situation in your story. You know, Foxwood Hall has a responsibility to little Barlow. So for those of us who, you know, literally don't know any more about how English country estates are set up beyond what we see in an Agatha Christie movie or Downton Abbey episode, how are they kind of set up and run to sort of create that tie and that responsibility?
Well, more so than here, a country estate and even the village around it was more of a family. You know, the aristocrats were the head of the household, so to speak. But people took care of each other. Yes, they each had their roles. And if you were born to the servant class, that's where you were stuck. But even so, you had a place in that family, and it was an important one. You helped keep the wheels running, however small or large your job was. And it was very much the responsibility of the aristocrat to kind of oversee everything and to make sure that, you know, everyone, the welfare of everyone was looked after. Of course, that began to erode in the as the 20th century progressed. It became less and less like that. But when you think about it, it really has its roots in the feudal system, where, you know, you had the lord at the very top living in the manor, and everyone was beholden to him. They owed him their loyalty and their work. And he owed them protection. So, you know, what we have in Foxwood Hall isn't really much different in a lot of ways. Yes, it's driven more now by sentiment and tradition than the law of the land. But for these people who had a sense of honor, it was very important to uphold those traditions.
You mentioned another thing that had a big impact on your characters' lives and how they found themselves and their circumstances that led them to letting these people into their home, and that's war. Your Gilded Newport series, which is set in the Gilded Age in the late 1800s, was a period that was shortly after a war that was very traumatic, killed a lot of people, scarred a lot of lives, and it was an era kind of marked by sort of extravagant consumption and corruption. And Mark Twain came up with Gilded Age as more of an right. insult than a compliment.
Yes, it was.
But the 1920s is also right after a major war, especially in England, killed huge portions of the marriageable age men population, and scarred and traumatized everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it was another age of extremes with the Lost Generation and women cutting their hair and putting on short dresses and booze and smoking, and at least in the U.S., prohibition and organized crime. So are actually a lot of parallels between the two. So, what sort of prompted you to pick two periods to write in that were both very much influenced by a major war and such huge societal shifts that seem glamorous on one level, but the deeper you look, there's actually a whole lot more going on under there.
There is, although my reasons for writing in each time period are really very different. When I set out to write my Newport books, I chose the most, I guess you could say, conspicuous consumption. The most conspicuous thing about Newport, Rhode Island are those mansions. And, setting it in 1895 to begin with was perfect because that was the year the Breakers, as we know it today, opened. It had just completed its construction, and they had held their first parties there in the summer of 1895. So really that was more about how do I best showcase the city of Newport, because of my husband's history there, my history there with him. It was more of a place. It was the place that drew me to that particular time and setting. With the Lady's Maid books, though, I didn't want to set it during the war. I know a lot of people do, and those books are fascinating, and there's so much material to work with there. But when I look at people and human nature, I like those in-between periods. During the war, people knew what they had to do. There were roles that people needed to fill, whether it be soldiers or women farming the land or working in the factories. There wasn't a lot of time for thought. It was a time to work and serve your country. But after the war, things became very ambiguous. The social classes were beginning to blur because these officers and aristocrats were fighting side by side with the common man and bleeding the same color. Women who had gone into the factories and were earning money for the first time in history, money of their own, suddenly were told, well, now you need to go home and be wives and mothers, even though there aren't enough men available for you to marry. Meanwhile, the aristocracy had lost so much of its wealth that, Phoebe's grandparents are... their world has really been shaken, and Phoebe has to deal with that throughout the books. She understands that these two extremely strong people are left a little lost in this new world that emerges from World War One. And Phoebe herself is very much shaped by the war years, because she may seem like a woman ahead of her time, but she spent her formative teen years driving a truck with supplies that they collected at Foxwood Hall. She would drive them to the train depots, and you know, she would organize collections and things like that. So she grew up being useful and having to plan and organize and do things. Everything about these characters has been partially molded by the war, but now that the war is over, they have to figure out what the world is going to do and what their place in it should be.
And I feel like you must have peeked at my questions ahead of time, because that segues perfectly into my next one. Phoebe is a very modern woman by, you know, post-World War One standards. And she comes up against some very conservative values, you know, held by her elders and as well as her entire social class in general. So how did she kind of navigate being a young woman who, you know, as you said, was, you know, grew up in a war, is, you know, sort of come of age into the 1920s, which was a whole huge societal shift, while also being a member of a community that, you know, as you said, traces itself back to the feudal system, and in a way kind of maintains their identity by not changing much from the way things were in, you know, 1500 and whatever, or 1300 and whatever.
Right. And she's very conflicted. On the one hand, she would like to leave Foxwood Hall and go out into the world, attend university, study maybe law or something like that, and become a working woman. She sees herself being able to do those things, while at the same time, she may want to leave and you know, experience more of the world, but she doesn't at the same time want to leave her family. She doesn't want to let her grandparents down. She knows her brothers and sister, her brother and sisters need her. I don't remember which book I put it in, but I explained the conflict between her and her older sister happened because before her father left for the war, he told Phoebe, "I need you to look after the family because you're the steady one," basically, is what he told her. So he recognized it in her. So she is left with this responsibility that she takes seriously. She doesn't resent it because she loves her family, but some of her ambitions have been frustrated, and she is in somewhat of a holding pattern when it comes to that, because she hasn't given up her dreams, but she also hasn't initiated anything yet to really fulfill them. I guess investigating crimes helps her channel some of that creative and ambitious energy.
In addition to the tension between ancient and modern ways, you also examine the tension between social classes. You know, in one scene in Deadly Endowment, a reporter wants to interview Eva, the lady's maid, for her, he called it her less lofty perspective. And right. Eva's surprised that anyone, you know, even wants to talk to her. You know, to modern Americans, you know, our idea of a maid or a housekeeper is completely different than what a maid or a housekeeper would have been, you know, 100 years ago to landed gentry in England. And from what I understand, you know, there was a hierarchy even within the servant classes. So would you please tell us what it would have meant to Eva to be employed at a place like Foxwood Hall? And also, what specifically is a lady's maid versus any other type of maid?
Well, a lady's maid is a lady's personal maid. She attends to her clothing, her jewelry, her shoes. She makes sure her wardrobe and everything she needs for her day is organized and readied for her. And she will fulfill basically any function that her lady might need her to do, whether it's, you know, getting the post or getting some flowers to put in her room, or, you know, any little errands that a lady might need done. For somebody like Eva, who came from a farming family, being a lady's maid is really quite quite an achievement for her. I have it that she did attend the local finishing school on scholarship because she's very intelligent. Of course, she never finished. So somebody in her position would more likely end up probably as a housemaid. The housemaids did the cleaning, or, you know, the laundry maids, of course, did the laundry, or then there were the kitchen maids. So a lady's maid was really kind of a cushy job in a house like that, along with maybe the housekeeper who gave the orders but didn't necessarily have to do a lot of the heavy work. So she would have been, she's very grateful for that job. And because she has the family, she works for the Renshaws, who are compassionate, very fair-minded people. She's especially lucky because, you know, ladies' maids, even though it is a good position, weren't always treated that well. It all depended on their employer. What was the rest of that question?
Oh, that was it. What would this have meant to Eva?
Yes. And I did want to add that somebody in her position, or any servant, really was neither seen nor heard at the wrong time. So someone like Eva was always in the background. Ladies' maids tend to dress in dark colors, very plain clothing. They didn't stand out. They were in the shadows doing the work, and the same with housemaids. I remember in Downton Abbey, and this was true, one of the maids who was cleaning out the fireplace being told, "You can't be seen in this part of the house, so hurry up with that and go back downstairs." For a maid or any servant to be asked to give an opinion would have been very unusual.
And how does the fact that servants were basically supposed to be like the furniture, just kind of there, and what kind of opportunities does that give you as a mystery writer? I can imagine someone not noticing the quiet person in the dark clothing in the background and saying something that perhaps they shouldn't have said.
Right. It really, having the dual sleuths, having Phoebe and Eva, lets me have like a sleuth who's in two places at once, and where Phoebe probably wouldn't get anything out of people in the servant class or the working class because they would be too tongue-tied to be able to talk to her naturally. That's what Eva can do. Eva can work up little friendships or, become someone's confidant because she's on the same level whereas Eva could not go upstairs and talk to any of the guests. I mean, that would be completely inappropriate. And that's always Phoebe's job, to talk to the aristocrats, the higher ups. So really it's a nice balance. And it's interesting for me because I get to go upstairs and downstairs, and I go back and forth on who I feel is more interesting. I know in the first book, I always couldn't wait to get back downstairs to the servants. I try to have a good balance of suspects who inhabit both worlds so that they can both, both get around and talk to everybody.
Now, would a lady's maid sort of be the women's equivalent of a valet or valet? I'm never sure how to pronounce that for the men.
Yes, exactly. I think in this country we say valet. Is that right? In England, it's valet with a T.
I don't say valet.
Yeah, that's exactly what a lady's. It's right, the female equivalent.
Okay, so she's kind of like Jeeves.
Kind of. Yeah.
That's several of your characters are members of a historical society, and
right,
some are just what that image conjures, and some are not what you'd expect in a historical society member. And I just want to, disclaimer, I'm a member of some historical society, so I'm not making fun of them at all, but I have to admit, you hear, the something, something, something historical society, and a picture pops into your head. So what inspired you to include a historical society as sort of members in a historical mystery? And also, did any real life historical societies influence you?
My husband and I are members of the Newport Historical Society. I always get this name wrong. I call it the Point Society, but that's not actually their name. But they're a group that archives and collects information about the Point section of Newport and the Preservation Society. So, I love a good historical society. I think I came up with it because I needed people to come to tour this house, and I wanted them to have connections with each other. How else were they going to get people to come? You couldn't advertise really. There was no way to get the word out, but having a local historical society really took care of that problem. So it just made sense.
Have you gotten any feedback from any historical societies or historians about your series? I know your Guild of Newport mysteries are actually sold in the gift shops of several of the historical mansions, and I think they might be at the Newport Historical Society bookstore too.
I'm not sure if they have them. I haven't had any feedback on the Lady and Lady's Maid books. I think it's more the other way around, where I've really tapped into the resources that the Newport, especially the Newport Historical Societies, have to offer, and have really based some plots around information I was able to get through those resources. And excuse me, we have a good friend who's on several of the historical societies who I can just send a message to, like, hey, do you know what the inside of this particular mansion looks like? And if she doesn't, she can find somebody who does. Or there was one instance where I was including the inn at Castle Hill, which is now an inn and restaurant. But it existed during the Gilded Age. And I said, I can't find anything on the inside of the house. I mean, it just doesn't exist. So she said, well, you know what? I'll go to lunch there. And she did. And she took pictures and drew me a map. And it was great. It was like I was there.
Oh,
And
it's
actually, I
wonderful.
had been there years ago, but it was such a long time that I just couldn't remember. So networking is so important in this in the writing world.
It's always good to have friends in
Yeah.
historical places.
Friends and yes, in historical places. That's right.
Now, A Deadly Endowment is set in May 1921. But just for fun, could you describe what Christmas would be like at Foxwood Hall?
Well, actually, the first book in the series was a Boxing Day mystery, which is the day after
Ah,
Christmas. So it
yes.
actually, we have a bit of Christmas incorporated. There was a huge Christmas tree in the Great Hall. Basically, it's funny because I just did a post on our Sleuths in Time Facebook page. I don't know if you know of a member of a group of historical authors. There are really some differences between an American and English Christmas. Of course, they have the tradition of Father Christmas. Some of the food is different. Some of the traditions are, of course, Yorkshire puddings served with sauces or gravies. I was surprised to learn that Brussels sprouts was a common side dish, although I don't know if that would have been true back then. Chestnut stuffing, Christmas pudding, which was usually made about a month ahead of time. For those who don't know, it's not a pudding, it's more of a cake, but it's steamed rather than baked. That was a very important tradition to have at Christmas. But the servants would have been working all Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. So Boxing Day was their either day off or half day off. Usually they would all maybe work in the morning, get the family set up with, some cold cuts and leftovers, whatever, and they could go about their business. And the family supplied them with little gifts and sometimes, little amounts of cash in boxes, and would distribute the boxes before the servants left for their day. And that's where Boxing Day, you know, that's where the name comes from. And in that particular book, something just awful is found in one of the Christmas boxes that lead Phoebe and Eva on their first murder investigation adventure.
Something much worse than socks that itch, right?
Much worse than socks or any of those gifts that you get, but you don't really want. I'll give you a hint. This did involve a ring. That's all I'm gonna say.
Okay, a ring of the kind that you don't want Santa to give you. Okay.
Well,
we'll leave people... it to the listener's imagination after that.
Okay.
Now, how about Christmas in Newport? I know the Newport mansions do it up right for Christmas. I don't know if you. I was actually in Newport for a year at the Naval War College, got a chance to see a couple of the mansions, even though they were, you know, had to scale back because of circumstances. But this year they're making up for lost time. And I've been seeing the photos of some of the fabulous Christmas decorations at the Newport Mansion. So what would Christmas in Newport have been like?
Yeah, just beautiful. Well, first of all, those mansions would have been shut up and dark at Christmas time. The families only use them during the summer. And once the summer season was over, they were gone. So yeah, such beautiful houses. And yet, like I said, they were dark at Christmas. There was nothing going on there. You know, local people, of course, celebrated. It would have been very, you know, modest types of celebrations. But there are so many kinds of churches and so many denominations of churches in Newport that I'm sure that day the churches would have been full. But yeah, would have been modest, you know, nothing over the top, nothing, no conspicuous consumption, no over the top gifts for anybody. But it, you know, I'm sure it had a lot of heart, especially in a neighborhood like the Point section there on the water, where everybody knew each other. I can imagine that it was just a very homey, charming time where neighbors got together as they do now, and probably shared some you know, hot toddies and eggnog and things like that.
Because if you want the really Christmassy, so you'd be better off going to 1920s Foxwood Hall than
probably
Gilded Age Newport. Okay.
Or maybe New York, because I guess that's where most of the families would have been back in the city or at some of their other estates, you know, on Long Island or places like that. Know. Yeah.
Oh, so just hop on the road. hop on a boat and head up to New York City for a Gilded Age Christmas there.
Right.
And for folks who sort of want to experience the 1920s vicariously or the Gilded Age vicariously, where can they buy a copy of your books, either A Deadly Endowment or one of a book from one of your other series?
Well, they can be ordered online from pretty much, you know, any bookseller, whether it's an independent or, you know, one of the bigger ones. You can go to your independent bookstore, and if they don't happen to have what you're looking for, you can always ask them to order it for you. Most will always do that. So they're readily available. And of course, if you happen to go to Newport, you can look for them at the mansion stores or some of the bookstores there. So yeah, as far as I know, everything is still in print, and you know, they're available in the soft cover, hardcover, audio, and ebooks. So,
oh, and yeah. I can vouch for Charter Books in Newport because I actually saw them there.
I haven't seen them yet. I can't wait to go back and visit. We're going in the spring, I think.
It's an awesome store. When did they open it? They opened it while I was there. So it's a fairly new store that they may be a year old now, but it's a great local bookstore with you know, wonderful local booksellers. And they had all of your Gilded Age books right up front in the mystery section.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear.
Besides on bookshelves, where can readers find you to find out more about Newport and Foxwood Hall and your historical novels? On social media or a website?
Yes, they can find me at alyssamaxwell.com. And I actually have a couple of pages dedicated to the Newport books. I haven't done that yet for the Lady and Ladies Made books, but there's lots of information about Newport. And from there, you can find me on Facebook. I even have some Pinterest pages set up for both series, Instagram, Twitter. Yeah, and on Facebook, I have Alyssa Maxwell, the Gilbert, the Gilded Newport Mysteries page. And I mentioned Sleuths in Time earlier. There's eight of us in that group. So anybody who loves historical mysteries, please check out Sleuths in Time on Facebook. It's a lot of really wonderful writers that I work with and, share our experiences with.
Yeah, and I'll put the links for those in the show notes.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you for joining me in the corner today, Lisa. I know you've got holiday things going on, so I appreciate you taking the time out to chat with me.
Oh, I appreciate this so much. Thank you, Alexia.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. You've been listening to me chat with Lisa Manuel, who, as Alyssa Maxwell, writes the Lady and Ladies Made Mysteries as well as the Gilded Newport Mysteries. Her newest is A Deadly Endowment. Until next time, happy holidays and goodbye. Thank you for listening to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Alexia Gordon, award-winning author and host of the show. Tune in next time for another chat with an author writing on the lighter side of crime. Until then, goodbye.